All right, and welcome to the Utah Puck Report. I'm your host, Jay Stevens, and I'm kind of solo today. No co-hosts. Everybody's off on summer break and having a good time, and we're interrupting somebody else's summer break, though. A guy who's managed to stay busy in hockey since becoming a legend here in Salt Lake. We have Rich Chernomaz on the show today. Cherno, how are you?
Good, Jay. Great to be on. It's been a long time since I've been back in Salt Lake.
Yeah, how long has it been since you've been to Salt Lake?
I was there just for a 4 or 5 hour stop there on a trip back from Europe, laid up at the airport on my way back to Vancouver.
Okay.
So other than that, it's been a long time.
So you just kind of looked out the windows from the airport and had some had some good memories.
pretty much. Oh yeah, no, I had great 6 years in Salt Lake back in the day when we were, you know, Calgary's farm team, and and we're fortunate enough to play with a lot of great players and win a championship. And it was a lot of fun. Met a lot of really nice people there from Salt Lake.
Yeah, so I want to get into that more, but first I want to learn more about you in the beginning, and that's kind of what we do, is we just kind of tell the story of our guys. And like, so where were you born, and when did you start playing hockey?
I was born actually just outside of Winnipeg in a place called Selkirk, Manitoba, and my dad worked in a steel mill there, and the mill was downsizing, and so when I was 6 years old, my parents decided to pack up, and we moved out here to British Columbia. We had some friends and some family that had moved out here previous from Manitoba, and I was 6 years old at the time, and started playing hockey a year later when I was seven, turning eight.
Okay. And so what are your fondest memories of those days, like just growing up and playing hockey? Did you get to play with your dad? Was your dad a hockey player?
No, my dad wasn't. He was a curler. That was the extent of his sports career.
Okay, okay.
My mom was actually a pretty good athlete. She played pretty competitive fast pitch, and I remember being the bat boy when she was playing out here. And, so it was really, those days growing up here in a very relaxed atmosphere in a very small town. I had a lot of good memories of when I first started playing hockey here.
So one of the things we found out, like one of the reasons everybody likes to hear about how you grew up and get your backstory, that kind of feeds into how you became the player that you became. And now you're telling me that you were a bat boy and you grew up really in a relaxed atmosphere, but that's definitely not how you played. So we got to figure out where all your intensity came from, and you had such leadership qualities here.
I think, as far as the hockey career was concerned, when I was my second year playing Bantam hockey was kind of when I really took off and had a really good year, with the travel team out of my hometown, Port Alberni. And then the next year I played as a 15-year-old in an island league that was a combination of senior men's and junior B players. And then the next year, had a really good year that year too. And then the next year I went out to Saskatoon and lived with my aunt and my uncle that lived out there in Saskatoon, and played in the junior provincial league. And that year, the Blades, the Saskatoon Blades and the WHL had a fair amount of injuries, and they brought myself up and a guy by the name of Mark Habscheid, who had a tremendous playing and coaching career too. And then I was actually at that time, I was on the protected list from the Victoria Cougars in Saskatoon, and Victoria just made a deal for me to play out for the rest of the season with Saskatoon. And then the following year is when I started my junior career with the Victoria Cougars.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know that you'd hear of a team working out a deal, and kind of, so you were kind of on loan with the blades?
Yeah, I was on loan just for, I think it was about half the season. And then the next year, when I went to Victoria, that had a very good first year and played with guys. Well, Grant Fuhr was my roommate, and
wow.
Barry Peterson, Tory Robertson, Bob McGill, Paul Sear, Mark Morrison. I mean, we had a pretty strong team, and we ended up winning the Western League that year and going to the Memorial Cup. But Dale Howarchuk and his team from Cornwall were just a little bit too strong for us.
Man, those are some big names you're throwing around. Yeah, so that was your first year juniors. You went to your first full season juniors. You went to the Memorial Cup.
Yeah. And then that year was the year I was drafted by the old Colorado Rockies. It was a 26th pick overall, and at that time that was a second round pick.
Oh, wow.
As opposed to that being a first rounder today. I think there was only, so there would have only been 21 teams in the NHL at that time. And I can't remember how many years. I was actually drafted in 1981.
Okay.
And then after I was drafted, came back and played a couple more years junior. And then that year that I turned pro was when the Colorado Rockies had moved the franchise to the New Jersey Devils.
Right.
And that's where I started my pro career.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't even know anymore that and I've asked around because, you know, I try to do a bunch of back work on the players from here that I interview, and I ask people, I'm like, do you remember, you know, the Colorado Rockies? And people they only think of the baseball team. So do you have any of those? Do you have that jersey on your wall? Your NHL jersey from the Rockies?
No, I don't have any of the jerseys on my walls, but I have them. I have them tucked away in a couple of trunks and stuff. And I've tried to, you know, throughout my career, keep at least one jersey of all the all the teams I played on and coached.
Oh, cool! I wish I would have done that just for the teams that I've e-bugged on here, because I would have had so many. I just never had the opportunity. All right, so you turn pro, and now you're property of the New Jersey Devils. And so did you get put in the farm club at that point?
Yeah, so I started actually, so I signed a level entry contract, and it was a 3+1. And I started in New Jersey, and in New Jersey at that time, they were a relatively weak and thin organization. And so a lot of us young guys, Pat Verbeek, Rocky Trache, Kenny Danico, Kirk Mueller, Joey Sorella. These were the guys that, you know, were in my time era, and unfortunately we didn't get off to a very good start, and three of us had gotten sent down to the minors and played up in Portland, Maine in the American League. And going into my last year of my contract, played 35 games or 25 games in Jersey, and my contract was up, and they wanted to renew my contract, but only offered a two-way contract, and so I decided to make the jump to Calgary's organization, and because they had sweetened the pot a little bit more for me in that regard. And when I went to Calgary, I mean, they were at that time very, very strong. They were very strong, you know, with the depth of their forwards, and that's how I ended up in Salt Lake. Because Salt Lake was a farm team there at that point in time when Calgary had won the Stanley Cup.
Right. So did you get – how many games did you get? I think you played, what, three games, four games with Calgary?
I was up for a couple 1 year, and then I think the year – before the second to last year I was in Salt Lake, I played 10 or 11 more. In total, I played 51 NHL games.
Okay.
Yeah. A 10-year career.
So when you got assigned to Salt Lake, what did you know of Salt Lake City?
Well, I didn't really know that much about the city. I just knew kind of the position, because I was 25, turning 26 at the time, and Cliff Fletcher, who, you know, really kind of took it upon himself to sit down with me and explain to me exactly, you know, I was kind of like a depth guy. I was the first year I was there at Calgary's training camp, myself, and Theron Fleury were the actual last two guys to get cut. And so I went down to Salt Lake. He went back to Moose Jaw, where he played junior. And then, you know, Cliff had said, expressed to me, he goes, you know, we want you to be a depth guy within our organization, but we want you also to be a guy that, you know, really kind of, you know, take the leadership role in Salt Lake and help develop the younger guys, and at the same time, you know, be a strong presence on the ice for the team in Salt Lake.
And is that, was that, how did you accept that role? Because, I mean, obviously you're still trying to make the NHL, and your dream is to be in the NHL, and now they're telling you to be the guy to help develop the other guys. Was that a tough pill to swallow at first? Or
I think it's more of a situation where, you know, when I was at training camp, and that was that first year that I went to Calgary's organization, was the year that they won the Stanley Cup, and that was the same year that we won the Turner Cup in Salt Lake. And, you know, after training camp was over, I mean, it was very easy for me to see, unless they start moving guys out or train a few guys, that there wasn't really going to be much opportunity in Calgary because they had so much depth and they were, you know, quite obviously very strong that year. So, and, you know, as it worked out in Salt Lake, you know, I just kind of felt that, you know, you never ever give up the hope that, you know, maybe you get traded or maybe you get called up and you know, make the most of your time while you're up and stuff in that regard. So, you know, at that point in time, I was just, you know, just try to stay very positive and play hockey and enjoy it and continue to get better.
And you come in and you win the championship as a year, as, you know, you're the leader of the team. And you guys had, I mean, the Golden Eagles, those years were just amazing to watch. And you had so much depth even here for a farm club. And then you mentioned Theo Fleury, but tell us a little bit about those playoffs and the guys that were there when you were, that you remember riding that, those playoffs with the Salt Lake Golden Eagles to win that championship.
Well, I just remember a couple of guys that we had some really good draft picks, and Stephen Matteau, and he's the one guy that stands out particularly for me. And then we picked up guys like Peter Lappin and Jimmy Johansson that came out of colleges before the playoffs started. And then, you know, right at the very start of the playoffs, we ended up getting Theo for the first 10 games, you know, that really did a, you know, amazing job helping us get to the finals. But he was under, you know, under that rule as a junior player that he could only play 10 pro games for us. But that, you know, like any team, you know, down the stretch, when you have the opportunity to strengthen your team, always gives you the best chance. And, you know, Shaky DeMore and Natty played outstanding for us in the playoffs. And, you know, when you kind of really look back, I mean, you know, especially that particular year, it was relatively easy. I think the first two rounds, first round we played Denver, which was the Rangers farm team. I think we swept them, and I think the next round went five games, and then we played Flint, Michigan in the finals, and I think that series went six games, if I remember correctly.
So
back, you know, when you're young like that, you know, you're playing because you love the game, and you know, we had a very strong chemistry within our dressing room, and you know, we just had a lot of fun together that year.
Yeah, And you guys were so amazing to watch. And I was telling the people around here, we've had some pretty big guests on the show already, you know. And I was like, this is kind of a childhood hero of mine that we're interviewing today. And just watching you guys and the confidence and the way you had, because wasn't that Mike Richter with Colorado the first round that you guys just swept?
He was, yes, he was. Mike Richter, Simon Wheeldon. There was actually a couple of defensemen that had actually fairly lengthy careers in the NHL that were young draft picks at that time for the Rangers organization.
Yeah.
But you know, I think overall the one thing that really might stand out in people's minds is the fact that, you know, as skilled a team that we had in those first couple of years in Salt Lake, we were well coached, and you know, with Bobby Francis and Paul Baxter that first year, and the ongoing years with Bobby as well. But we didn't lack any toughness. I mean, we had some pretty tough boys on the team. So for guys like myself, it was easy for me to be able to play my game and not get intimidated by some of the other opponents, you know, tough guys or whatever, because those, you know, guys like, you know, Stu Grimson, Rick Hayward, Kerry Clark, Derek Banks.
Yeah.
I mean, you just go down the line with a lot of those guys that, you know, if anybody, you know, on the opposing teams touch the, you know, the key players or, you know, the offensive minded players that were maybe not that big at that time, those guys were, you know, I mean, they were pushing me out of the way to get into the fight. So.
Man, and it was so much fun to watch. But when you drop names like Stu Grimson, I mean, and Cruz, I just remember those guys. Just
that's
unbelievable.
Another guy I failed to mention, but like I said, I'm sure there's probably another five or six guys that I haven't mentioned too as well, especially on our defense corps. So, I mean, Steve Smith for 1 year, I think. Todd Gillingham.
Oh yeah, I mean, Gillingham. Yeah. Was Marty Simard? How was he? Was he a
Martin Simard? Another guy, you know, Darwin McCutcheon. I mean, the list just continues and goes on that way.
Yeah, and you say so that's your recipe for success in 87-88. And how do you think that is now? When as a coach now, do you try to build that same kind of a recipe? You get your skill players, and then do you have protectors still, or is that part kind of died out?
I think that, you know, people will say, and you know, I will definitely say that the change of the rules and how the ice is laid out with the icings and the offsides, and that they've really tried to speed up the game and make it more dynamic to watch than it already was. And so the way the teams, you know, and the GMs are building, especially at the pro level and even at the junior level, everybody's building for speed and finesse. And so guys, you know, back then, you know, when I came out of junior turning pro, there wasn't nearly the insight of young or smaller, you know, offensive guys that maybe skated well. If you weren't, you know, 6 foot plus and willing to drop your gloves, there was no room for you at the NHL level.
Right.
And unless you were, you know, exceptionally, you know, dynamic with, you know, a skill level or with speed, it was very, very tough in those times to really crack the teams in the NHL, because everything was based off of size and toughness and, you know, combined with a skill. But that's where I see where the big difference is in today's game, that there's less toughness. There's, you know, average size of the teams has gone down. But the speed of the game is, you know, tremendously improved in that regard.
So how do you think a player, you were a speedy guy, right? What were your main strengths back then? Speed and puck handling, or?
Skating was, I wouldn't say I was an above average skater. I think I was a very fluent skater. You know, and when you watch, you know, players that have a very fluent style, you know, they just look like they're floating on the ice a little bit in that sense, floating in the sense of, you know, just their rhythm that makes them look quick. But I think more so is just because of the lack of size and strength that I had, which, you know, in my opinion, kind of maybe hurt my opportunity a little bit in that regard. But in today's game, I think guys that were my size and had, you know, have some skill and have some speed or get money, getting a much greater opportunity than they did back in those days.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at is, well, we've seen that, and we've had a guest on. I don't know if you know, are you familiar with Greg Lieb?
Yeah, I know Greg. I actually coached Greg in Europe 1 year.
Oh, okay.
In Germany.
All right, well, yeah, that makes sense, in the DEL. I talked to Greg, and we talked to other people about Greg, and I asked him the same question I'm kind of asking you now is, you know, in today's game, would today's game fit him better than it did in his time? So you were a skill player, you were a skater, and you were a leader, and you had guys that would open the ice for you. But do you think your style would be better today? Would you be an NHL player on a starting roster now with your skill set if you were 10 years younger?
Well, I think it's definitely put it this way. I was a bubble guy, and even though I only played in three NHL organizations over the 12 years that I played in North America, I think I would have had a greater chance in, you know, today based on the skill level that I had back, you know, back then. I think too that, you know, the way the draft works and how the teams, you know, have so many different dimensions of and ideas behind the players that, you know, they draft today. They're much more patient with their draft picks, than they were back then in regards to, you know, giving them every ample opportunity to play, their style of game. With a couple of veterans, and I remember, you know, when Doug Risebrough was the GM of Calgary after Cliff left to go to Toronto, I came up for 10 games, and I think 9 of the 10 games, I played on the right side with Joel Otto, who was, you know, a very effective checking centerman, and Craig Berube, you know, who was a, you know, he was a policeman. He was a tough guy. So, you know, nothing against those players, but, you know, I was a finesse guy, and I think if I would have had an opportunity to play with a centerman that was more of a disher or more of a setup guy, you know, I might have had that opportunity a little bit more than I did. But at the same time, you know, because a guy like Ciarán Fleury was right behind, you know, me, and a few years younger, really kind of broke the ice in regards to that little guy syndrome that, you know, other teams never took a chance on, that when he came into the league and he got that opportunity in Calgary, he jumped on every opportunity that he got. And I'll never forget, so the year that he turned pro, he came and started his pro career in Salt Lake. And he got called up on New Year's Eve. We'd played 36 games, I think, at that time in Salt Lake in the season. And I think he had about 72 or 74 points in those 36 games.
Good Lord.
From that time on, after he got called up in Calgary, that's when he took off. So, you know, I think it's really, you know, it's always comes down to decision making within the, you know, the coaches and the GMs of, you know, what they think and who they foresee being, you know, the potential longtime NHL player. And, you know, unfortunately, I just never got that opportunity in Calgary, but I think it was more so because of the depth that they had, more than anything.
So what was it like to see a guy like Ciarán Fleury come through the organization? I mean, you see this little guy walk into the locker room. Did you already know everything about him when he came in, or was, you know, did he have to prove
himself? No, not at all. Not at all. And you know, the old, you know, saying, a lot of skeletons in the closet. And you know, I'm very proud of a guy like Theo that, through all his career and the ups and downs that he had, especially in his personal life, that, you know, he's still with us today to talk about,
right,
you know, some of the things that, you know, put him into that position that he got put in his personal life and how he was able to cope and deal with all those, you know, I would say nightmares coming out of junior hockey where, you know, those things in today's game where, you know, I mean, people are going to jail for those types of things now. And, you know, it's just fortunate that, you know, like I said, a guy like Theo and everything he went through, that he's still, you know, with us today to talk about, you know, his overall life and how that affected his life, everything that he went through and experienced.
Yeah,
when he was a young guy.
He's definitely become an advocate for that and opened a lot of people's eyes to the fact that that was happening then and it could happen now. And I think, you know, with him going through what he went through and then righting his ship, I think he's going to be able to change a lot of people's lives for the better. But
very much.
But what was it like from a skill set? I mean, you see this guy walk into the locker room. Did you know he was going to be such a phenomenal player? Did you know that the minute he hit the ice with you guys? Or?
Not right away. Not right away. I mean, he was a very confident young man when he, you know, when he came up as a 19-year-old, especially, you know, the first link of a. I think the biggest thing is what you saw on the ice was, you know, being not a very tall guy. He had amazing leg strength and balance, and he was very, very difficult to knock off the puck. And I think that was probably his biggest attribute, you know, as a player, based on basic fundamentals that, you know, his balance and his leg strength was amazing.
Yeah. Well, both of you guys, like, I remember the first time I saw both of you guys off the ice, and it just looked like you guys had fire extinguishers under your calf skin. You know, your calves were so big. I just remember thinking, oh, man, if this is how hockey players are built, I gotta hit the gym and start lifting things with my legs. You guys were, it was amazing to see. I mean, you both, like, I can't tell you how many kids around here are named Theron because of his quick impact. And he wasn't here that long, a year and a half.
No, like, I don't think he was there a full year.
Yeah, so yeah. 10 games 1 year and then up to New Year's. I remember being at that game, and as we were leaving, somebody mentioned that Fleury had got pulled up after the New Year's game. Because I don't know if you remember, but that was a New Year's Eve party at the Salt Palace. Yeah. And so
that's when he got the call when we were at the party.
Oh, yeah. And it spread around. Like, everybody, all the fans all of a sudden knew, and it was kind of a – yeah, we all knew. Like, we knew he was not going to be here long. But man, you guys had such an impact on this market, and you were such a leader here. And when anybody talks about the Salt Lake Golden Eagles, the names that come up, like your name, Theron Fleury, Lyle Bradley, you know, and Palazzari, obviously. Nobody ever brings up the goaltenders. We had some amazing goaltenders in those years, and you mentioned Shakey, and you know, we had some other guys come through. I'm forgetting his name all of a sudden.
Trevor Kidd, Trevor, Jason Mazzotti.
There you go.
Rick Hines. Was Rick Hines back in before us?
Yeah. Rick Hines was there, and Paul Skidmore. I mean, we had some amazing goaltenders.
Yeah.
But you guys are what people think of when they think of the Salt Lake Golden Eagles, and I can tell you that every time that the Utah Grizzlies have a coaching vacancy, that your name is all over the message boards. Like, everybody wants you to, bring Cherno back. And I was like, man.
Unfortunately, I've never gotten a call, though.
Really? I cannot believe that blows my mind with the coaching history you have and the attachment that our market has to you. I cannot believe they haven't called you. So I've got a couple more things I want to talk to you about. We'll get into your coaching career, but as your career comes down to, you know, your playing days are coming to an end, let's talk a minute about the roller hockey. Tell us your,
okay.
How's that little blip on your radar? Tell me about how that all came about and what you remember of it.
Well, I can't even remember the fella's name that actually started the. He was the fella that I think invented Sport Court.
Yes.
Do you know his name, by the way?
I'm totally blanking on it right now, and he's a local.
Yeah.
Local
so anyway, he had bought the franchise, the RHL franchise, and Kenny Morrow, who actually was the defenseman for the New York Rangers for years, actually got asked to coach the team. And then he called me and, you know, asked me if, you know, if I'd like to play and if there were some of the other guys from the Golden Eagles, like Rick Bassard played 1 year, Todd Harkins played that first year. There was a few of the other guys too and stuff. So, and then the first year we played actually in a parking lot out in South Valley somewhere.
Yeah,
at a mall.
Yeah, the Southtown Mall.
Yeah, Southtown Mall. And then the next year he actually moved the team to Vegas and we played out of the UNLV rink there in Vegas the next year.
Yeah.
And after that, it was 2 years. It was, you know, I think 2.5 months or 3 months. But the training actually, you know, playing hockey on rollerblades was amazing come training camp when, you know, we were doing our testing and stuff. So the VO2 test for oxygen intake was the best that I ever had in my whole career, playing those 2 years of roller hockey in the summertime.
It's weird because a lot of hockey purists are against using roller hockey or inline hockey or whatever you want to call it as training for hockey. But then you see there are guys in the NHL right now, and one name that really stands out was Alex Tange, that played a ton of roller hockey growing up and then was a phenomenal stick handler and always in good shape. What do you have a viewpoint on
right.
that? Would you tell your players now to use roller hockey as off-season training?
Well, I mean, you just look at how much the off-ice training of what the players were doing back 30 years ago to what they're doing now.
Right.
It's evolved a lot, and it's a little bit of everything that, you know, but everything is so specified now in training the muscles that are actually used for ice hockey and the sport of ice hockey. But, you know, to me in general, I mean, you know, you have natural athletes, whether they're playing hockey, golf, baseball, basketball, whatever, that just have that gift of being able to pick up a sport real quick. And I had nothing but positive results from playing the roller hockey, and I'm sure a lot of other guys, whether now or before or for the future, will also have, will have positive results in that regard.
Do you remember during your RHI days, do you remember going on to the opposing team's bench for do you remember the big fight at Southtown?
I think there was one time, yeah, I remember correctly, but, I mean, it was just part of the game now. Or back then. I mean, now it's, you know, it's whether it's frowned upon or whatever, I'm not really sure. But, I mean, they really try to, you know, calm down the violence and the fighting in hockey and stuff over the, you know, the last 15, 20 years. And I just think, you know, for the type of sport that, you know, and aggressiveness in the sport of hockey that it's always nice for fans to see that once in a while. And I think you really notice it at the NHL level where, you know, you don't nearly see as much fighting as you used to.
Right. Well, that was definitely one of the things that stood out. A lot of people asked about that to see if you remembered that fight. That I think it was against Vancouver, and we even had fans jumping over the boards. We had, I can't remember who it was, Dennis Nazari. He owned Salty Peaks. And he tried to come over and help you out anyway when you guys were getting in the little fisticuffs. So we had multiple people arrested, and that's just one of the legends of Rich Chernomaz in Salt Lake. So tell us about now as a coach. Where are you at these days? Where are you coaching this year?
Well, I'm actually in between jobs right now. So I would, you know, let's just back it up how I ended up going to Europe. So my last 2 years playing in North America, I was a player assistant coach in St. John's with Toronto's farm team. And in the second year, when I was in St. John's, we lost out in the second round of the playoffs. And at that year, there was a lockout. And there was a lockout from at the NHL level. And they didn't go back until I think it was at the end of January, and they had a condensed 40 or 38 game schedule till the rest of the year. So what they did was they took a bunch of us American Leaguers over to the World Championships.
Oh yeah.
And when I played for Team Canada, we lost out in the semifinals to go to the gold medal game, and we ended up beating Czechoslovakia for the bronze medal. And I had probably about four or five offers to go play in Europe that for that following year. And so that's actually how I ended up going over to Europe and then playing in Germany. And, you know, the bottom line, I mean, I was 30 years old at the time, and actually Cliff Fletcher wanted me to retire from playing, be a bench assistant for one more year in St. John's, and then, you know, start my coaching career in North America. And at that time, I just wasn't ready to retire at 30 years old. And that's why I ended up making the jump to Germany. And, you know, I mean, financially, it just made a lot more sense, too, and especially after pounding it out in the minors for 10 years from when I started back with New Jersey's organization. I just felt it was, you know, it was time to make that step. And, you know, my chances of playing NHL were over. And so I went there and did that and played four more years. And then just lucky enough, the team that I was playing on when I retired, they knew that I was going into the coaching field. And the following year, they'd asked me to coach the team. And so I did. And, you know, it was the highest level hockey in Germany at the DEL level, and coached there in a place called Schwenningen, which is down in the southwest region of Germany. And then from there went to I took a step back because I was there 2 years, and the market was a smaller market team, and they were losing sponsors because it wasn't a very big city, and the money actually was going up for the players at that point in time. So they were going back down to the second league. So I went to Cologne as an assistant coach the following year and worked with a guy that had been in the league but had both jobs as coach and GM. And so my first year in Cologne, he ended up getting fired, which was an Olympic year in February. And then I just took over for the rest of the year. But my fate was well known then, that I was not going to be back in Cologne the following year either. But we ended up winning the championship. So I ended up coming back and sitting back home. And then in November, the national teams in Europe always have a 1 week break. And so some opportunities came up, and ended up joining a team in Augsburg back in the DEL, and was there temporarily for the rest of the year. And then the guy I was coaching with in Cologne became the GM in Frankfurt, and he signed me before the end of the year to go to Frankfurt the following year. That was in 2004, and that next year we won another championship. And then I was in Frankfurt for the next 7 years after that. And then from there, another 2 years in a place called Ingolstadt, which is just outside of Munich. And then I went back to Frankfurt for 5 years after that.
How'd you end up with – didn't you coach Hungary a lot, like their international team?
Yeah, so what happened was when I was – the 2 years I was in Ingolstadt, the year – that I left Frankfurt, the owner died, and we had an owner. He was only 56 years old, and he had a massive stroke, brain hemorrhage, and he didn't make it through the summer. And he willed the team to his number one girlfriend, and just consequently willed her a 6 million euro of debt.
Oh wow!
That's how deep the team was in. And so she ended up selling it to a businessman in Frankfurt a year later. And then, you know, we had a good year that year. I think we ended up in second place and lost out. And we lost out in the quarterfinals that year, but we had a good year. and he was very positive, you know, with the fans, and, you know, saying that all the debt had been paid off, you know. And then he closed the doors 1 year later, and as it came out that, you know, any time a DL team or a team in the top division goes bankrupt, they have to start over again and go back down to the lowest league, which is the fourth league, and then kind of promote themselves back up each year from there. So when I went back to Frankfurt, and in between that time, I got the opportunity to coach a national team in Hungary, the U-20s and the men's. And that was actually a great experience, because you're going into, you know, a totally different way of life and way of thinking, and going into a country where half the country had, you know, basically been stolen. Like, I'm talking about the country of Transylvania that Romania took back from Hungary back in the Second World War days.
Right.
So you were dealing, you know, with a lot of people, and in particular, you saw it a lot in the players, where there was no belief, there was no trust, because, you know, way of survival in that country has always been, you know, everybody just looking out for themselves. And then when there was any sort of turmoil or decisions people had to make in their life, you know, that were critical decisions, everybody just seems to bunker down and, you know, don't want to put themselves or put their neck on the line to say the right thing or do the right thing. And
that's got to make it hard to coach. That's got a totally different mindset.
But it was very challenging. So during that 5 year tenure, you know, working with the national team, I was also the GM in Frankfurt, trying to get the team back up to the first league. And so we, you know, when I went back to Frankfurt to do that as a GM, we moved the team from the third league to second league, the first year I was back there. And the team's been in the second league ever since, because there is no relegation and promotion between the first league and the second league of Germany, which is really unusual, but they're actually bringing it back next year.
Okay.
And so anyway, my contract ran out, and the ownership decided that they wanted to go in a different direction, because they felt staying in the second league, there wasn't really a necessity to, you know, overpay their coaches or their GMs, and so they went in a different regard in that route. And so I ended up actually in England last year, and worked in a city called Nottingham.
Right.
And England, actually, their hockey has really improved a lot. They have.
Were you coaching Daryl? Were you coaching Daryl Olson's kid there?
Yes, I was. I was coaching Dylan. Yeah.
Okay. All right. All right.
And so that was kind of a new experience, and so they have a little bit different modus there. So their modus is that it's kind of like based on how it is in soccer, or football as they call it, where your playoff champion is not the champion for the year; it's the league champion, like they do in football, is the overall champion. So. When we started the season, after I think it was 24 games, we had been in first or second place, to that point. And then, we lost 4 games in a row in the month of December and dropped from second to third place, and the coach fired me.
Jeez.
Or the owner fired me, because he didn't think we were 6 points out of second place and 8 points out of first place. But he didn't think we had a chance, because he felt those teams were too strong that we would beat them again. So he fired me, and then made the assistant coach the coach for the rest of the year. And they ended up, you know, staying in third place the rest of the year. And I ended up going a week later after I got fired. I went back to Germany and ended up coaching a team in Ravensburg, which is in the southwest Germany in the second league, and won the championship.
Oh, wow.
But during that time that, you know, I lost my job in Germany, or I lost my job in England, and I was waiting to see what was going to happen in Germany, the team that I was coaching in Ravensburg hired a new coach for the following year. And so I just went into that situation knowing that I was done at the end of the year, regardless if we won or lost or anyway. And so now I'm just kind of relaxing up here in Canada and deciding in what direction I, you know, we want to go in, you know, in my career and with my family, and whether or not we go back to Europe or not, I don't know yet.
Just waiting for the phone to ring. Well, yeah. It doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me that you went in there and won the championship, and you've just always been a winner. And we're running out of time, so I've got to wrap things up. But I just can't thank you enough for taking the time and talking to us. You're somebody that I definitely want to have on again. And what I think would be fun is, and I know you recently hired Pataffy. Wasn't it Pataffy that you hired at some point and you brought him back in?
I did.
Okay,
I
so did, yes. What I'd like to do is I'd like to get you guys both on the show at the same time, and I'd love to just hear more stories about the Salt Lake Golden Eagles and the crazy stuff you guys did. And Cherno, again, you're just such an amazing leader, and you the impact. I don't know if you even know the impact you had on this market, but it's been amazing. Like I said, you're just a legend in this area, and I would not be surprised that if some point you get the phone call from the Utah Grizzlies or somebody around here with ties from here is going to want Rich Chernomaz running their team and being that guy that teaches their kids hockey again. So,
well, Jay, thank you so much for the kind words. And like I said, I've met a lot of tremendous and really nice people in Salt Lake over the years. And it would be nice to get back and rekindle some of those relationships again. But, you know, I mean, you know, as you get older and you start having your families and stuff, it just takes you away from things that you would like to do personally because prioritize your, you know, your commitments, especially with your kids and with your family and stuff that way. And being overseas for as long as I have, which has been 29 years, you know, it's tough sometimes to rekindle those relationships because, you know, you lose the contact sometimes, right?
Right. Okay, Rich, well, thanks so much for being on the show. That's gonna be it for us today. If you haven't subscribed yet, make sure you text the word puck to 57500. Or, of course, you can go to kslsports.com, look up podcasts. Make sure you subscribe to the Utah Puck Report. Cherno, once again, thanks so much for being on the show.
Okay, Jay.
And that's
thanks
it.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for the Utah Puck Report.